Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. At a time when affirmative action is being so passionately debated at every level of the country, from the Supreme Court right down to the high school classroom, well, affirmative action is very much on display in daily news reports from Iraq. You can't look at a photograph of U.S. troops without noting the racial diversity that marks the ranks of both the enlisted and the officer corps. Certainly for the past 30 years, affirmative action has been standard operating procedure in the armed forces. Today, with African Americans making up more than 12% of the officer corps, the military stands as the most integrated institution in America. Some members of the military brass say a racially diverse fighting force is a stronger force, and so they're speaking out in favor of affirmative action. It's a stand that's causing some embarrassment at the White House, where the Bush administration has aligned itself with opponents of affirmative action, at least in the University of Michigan case that's now pending at the Supreme Court. Senior U.S. military leaders are watching that case and wondering what a ruling against Michigan might mean for their military academies. So, Connection listeners, how well does the military demonstrate the effectiveness of affirmative action? And is it possible or reasonable to compare West Point and the University of Michigan Law School? Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. And I'm joined this hour by retired U.S. Air Force General Tad Olstrom, Director of the National Security Program at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. And General Olstrom was formerly superintendent of the U.S. Air Force Academy. We also have with us in the NPR studios in Washington, Roger Clegg, Vice President and General Counsel of the Center for Equal Opportunity in Washington. But we should go first to Colonel Michael Jones. Colonel Jones is Director of Admissions at the United States Military Academy at West Point. Colonel Jones, welcome to The Connection.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
I guess you're paying pretty close attention to whatever it is the Supreme Court is going to announce in a couple of months' time.
Yes, we are.
Tell me how it works at West Point, because people make that point about the integration of West Point classes. I don't know, do you run a point system? Is there a quota system? How do you do it?
Well, we run neither points like the University of Michigan, nor do we have a quota system. And let me get to the foundation of the Military Academy in the first place. Mm-hmm. When it was established in 1802, diversity was a requirement as part of the law establishing it to prevent us from becoming an elite school. When Thomas Jefferson signed the school into law, it required geographic representation from members of Congress in order to prevent us from being a school of New York or a school of Virginia, but in fact a school that represents the entire country. So the diversity issue is one that was built into us in the law because of the nomination process. Now, in terms of racial diversity, any candidates that we look at must be nominated, and they must be fully qualified, and we operate within the nomination law that's provided under Title 10 for African American and Hispanic and all other candidates who come in here.
Mm-hmm. And so if you have a goal of having a diverse student body and you don't use the point system and you don't use the quota system, how do you do it?
We do it by trying to find qualified candidates who are interested in coming to the military academy to be Army officers. And if we can't find them and we can't meet the goal, we don't meet the goal. We don't change any qualification standards in order to try to meet the goal that's established for us.
Now, help me understand this, because when you say you don't have a point system, but you do give extra weight when you're considering race in making a decision, is that splitting hairs? Is that just saying, well, we sort of have a point system, but we don't talk about it that way?
Well, nope. I don't think it's splitting hairs. Race is one of many factors that can be considered when we're qualifying a candidate. We look at leadership, we look at academic qualifications, we look at what faculty members have to say in the faculty evaluations are required to submit. We look at the nomination that the young man or young woman has. We look at their physical aptitude examination score. So there's a whole series of qualification guidelines that every candidate must have to go through. So as we determine the qualified pool that we're going to look at and nominations come in, then race may be a factor as a final issue in filling the class under the provisions of Title 10.
Now, Colonel Jones, stay with us for a couple of minutes. I know your time's short today, but I'd like to bring General Tad Olstrom in on this because
sure.
When you were at the Air Force, superintendent at the Air Force Academy, was it a similar system that you operated with there?
First, good to hear your voice, Mike, but yeah. Very similar, by the way, as to the process used at the Military Academy. A couple things I might want to emphasize, though, is that the process of admitting young men or women into the United States Air Force Academy, much as it is at the other academies, there's an academy board structure created where a number of folks actually vote on admission. Mm-hmm. It is important that when we address the academy board that they understand the usefulness and the importance of diversity in many ways. High SATs, athletes, scholars, Eagle Scouts, race, all different leadership issues, all of those things are important to understand by the Academy Board, so when they are presented with a case, they try to bring all these things together as individuals when they vote.
So again, not a point system, but one of the considerations when you're choosing a candidate for the Academy.
Absolutely right.
Now, Colonel Jones, you have a prep school at West Point as well. Is that a system whereby you hope to bring some candidates up to a level where they can compete?
Yes. First of all, it's not located here at West Point. It's in New Jersey, about an hour and a half away from here. And we, in fact, use it for candidates who help us meet different kinds of class composition goals. The primary focus is on soldiers who come from enlisted soldiers who come from either our National Guard or active duty forces who've shown promise to be officer leaders. And then beyond that, we put selected athletes, selected minorities, selected female candidates, selected leaders who don't quite meet our academic qualification. And with the year of preparation and academics at the prep school, can come here and be successful graduates of West Point and great officers.
And does that mean that you have an even higher percentage of racial diversity at that prep school?
Racial diversity at the prep school is about the same as it is here. We put in a number of African-American and Hispanic students right out of high school. We also bring in African-American and Hispanic soldiers from the regular Army who come in as serving members of the regular Army because the percentage of enlisted in that force is much larger than the general population at large.
All right, Colonel Jones, I know you have to go. I want to thank you for taking a bit of your day and spending it with The Connection.
Thank you, and General Olstrom, it was good talking to you, sir.
Thanks, Mike.
Have a good one.
Colonel Michael Jones is Director of Admissions at West Point. And Roger Clegg, thank you so much for your patience. I did want to sort of get a sense of how the system works before we talk about how we understand it and how it compares. When you're listening to Tad Olstrom and Michael Jones describe the admission system at West Point and the Air Force Academy, are you listening? Are you hearing in your mind similarities between that and what's done at some American universities?
Well, there are some similarities, but I also think that there are some important differences. Of course, the justification used by the University of Michigan is not a national security justification for its use of racial and ethnic preferences. Also, the degree of discrimination at the University of Michigan is much, much greater. One of the things that my organization does is use Freedom of Information laws to get college admissions data. And as it turns out, we've done a regression analysis for both the University of Michigan and also for the service academies.
I don't know what that is, a regression analysis.
Well, what we do is get the admissions data, and then we try to do a statistical analysis to see how heavily race and ethnicity are weighed in determining who gets in and who doesn't get in.
What did you find out?
Well, what we found out was that at the University of Michigan, the weight given to race was huge. The odds ratio, that is, if you had a white student and a black student with similar SAT scores and similar grades, the chance of the odds favored the African American candidate, by 174-1 at the University of Michigan.
Are those statistics that the university buys into, or is that, you know, would they contest that if they were here on the program?
I don't think they would contest it. I mean, you know, this is based on data that was supplied by the university itself. All we did was do the statistical analysis, and to my knowledge, the University of Michigan has never challenged the results that we got from our analysis.
Roger, just quickly, if I can, let me bring you back to our
Well, let me just finish. So it was 174-1 at the University of Michigan. At West Point, it was only 2-1, and at the Naval Academy, it was only 4-1. And we found no evidence, actually, that Latinos were given a preference at West Point at all. At the Naval Academy, the preference given to Latinos was only 3-1. So we're talking about a much less degree of discrimination.
So would the Center for Equal Opportunity say those numbers at West Point and at the Air Force Academy, 2-1, 4-1, that's okay?
No. I mean, it's still statistically significant. And, of course, you've just heard the superintendent of West Point and the former superintendent of the Air Force Academy admit that they do take race and ethnicity into account. And, of course, if you are considering race and ethnicity in deciding who gets in and who doesn't get in, then you are discriminating on the basis of race and ethnicity. I mean, if it doesn't make any difference, then you don't need to consider it at all. So they are still discriminating, and we do oppose that. I just wanted to make the point at the outset that we're talking about a different degree of discrimination and also a different justification for discrimination.
Fair enough, and we do want to bring our callers in a comparison. But General Ostrom, do you see it as discrimination?
Well, the word of discrimination would bother some folks, but in fact we discriminate against lots of young folks to come into the academies. If indeed we are looking for folks that have high SATs, there's a discrimination there. If we're looking for folks that bring leadership characteristics based on what we can see from high school, we're discriminating there. Every young folk who goes to a military academy is in fact being selected out of a much, much larger group for reasons that we think are very important to complement the military.
And are you saying that grades and height and
they're all discriminatory issues? Absolutely.
And I don't have any problem with discrimination on the basis of academic ability or physical ability or leadership ability, but I do have a problem with discriminating against people because of their skin color or because of where their ancestors came from.
Connection listeners, you've heard both sides. We're going to talk a little bit more when we come back after the break. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Certainly the military stands as an example of racial diversity, stretching back over 30 years of an affirmative action program put in after the Vietnam War in the 1970s. And that has some bearing. It certainly did at the Supreme Court last week when the discussion of the University of Michigan case was brought up. Is there a comparison that ought to be made there, or are the lessons from the armed services in any way useful in looking at American universities? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. This hour, a conversation about affirmative action in the military. And with us from a studio in Washington, Roger Clegg, Vice President, General Counsel of the Center for Equal Opportunity. Roger works on legal issues arising from civil rights laws, including the impact of affirmative action on higher education. Roger was formerly Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Reagan and Bush administrations. Ted Ostrom is in the studio with me. He is former Air Force General, formerly Superintendent of the U.S. Air Force Academy, and his own military education includes the Squadron Officer School, Air Command and Staff College, the Industrial College of the Armed Forces, and the Army War College. And I'm thinking before we go a little bit further, General Ostrom, we need to perhaps do a little bit better job in the history than I did in my line going into the break by saying it was just in the aftermath of the Vietnam War, because, of course, the whole idea of integration began earlier than that, didn't it?
Absolutely. President Truman, at the end of World War II, signed an executive order to end segregation, if you would, in the military. This was brought to light most clearly, I think, during Vietnam, where the number of enlisted had grown significantly in terms of minorities, but the officer corps was not representative. And there were certainly folks that said, this does not represent what we would like to see in our military. We'd like to have an officer corps, if you would, somewhat representative of the enlisted corps and better representative of what we see in the United States. And then the advent of the all-volunteer force immediately after Vietnam put into question whether or not we would have what it took in order to continue to bring this blend together within our officer corps. I think there was some threat on whether or not we'd be able to bring the diversity together.
And it has happened in the view of most military people. Do you share the view that the integration has been a successful thing?
Oh, the integration undoubtedly has been successful, but has it been as successful as people envision? I don't think we've seen, at least over this last 10 or 15 years, come into question whether or not we have become diverse enough. But it is because of the efforts that we have had, not only in educational institutions that bring us ROTC or later on officer training school candidates, but also the academies that bring us a good portion of that officer corps.
I want to quote you a line that Solicitor General Theodore Olson used before the Supreme Court in arguing against affirmative action. He said, in reference to the letter that you and a number of other senior military officers signed, he said, you know, the U.S. does not believe that black soldiers will only follow black officers into battle. Is he on the point there, or is he missing the point in your view?
I think he makes a point that is worthwhile talking about, and that is one that probably Roger would even agree to, and that is that we have a mixed society now. We are integrated in many ways, through marriages, etc. It's very difficult to find out who is a minority, and even when we go back to our academies, folks don't have to identify themselves as a minority. So it turns out I can't tell you how many minorities there are at the academies, nor can we tell you how many minorities are in our military officer corps.
Roger, this is a point that you make in your speaking and writing about it, that the very definition almost makes it impossible to set up rules, even if you're trying to enforce something like affirmative action.
I agree. And the one of the people who was recently on the Board of Admissions at the Naval Academy, Bruce Fleming, also made this point. And he concluded that it's very difficult, very ugly, really, to start insisting that people identify themselves according to their race and ethnicity and cross-examine them on whether they are sufficiently African-American or sufficiently Latino in order to be entitled to a preference, and that this is a kind of inquiry, a kind of factor that the Naval Academy should be getting away from. I agree with that, and so I don't understand why the officers in the brief that you referred to, Dick, are insisting that the military academies have to take race and ethnicity into account in deciding who gets admitted. I think that kind of discrimination is wrong, and insisting that people check this box or that box and then cross-examining them on whether the box is appropriate is wrong, too.
General Ostrom, I mean, it's a question that cuts right to the very heart of what we want to get at this hour. If affirmative action for the military is or has been a good thing in the minds or the views of the people in charge, how do you know that? How do you measure that? Why is it a good thing?
Number one is I think it's somewhat of a public expectation, or at least a nation's consciousness plays into this equation. And there's an expectation that if there must be a settling of some sort that compares this officer corps to the enlisted corps. And in the perfect world, we would not want to have to designate minorities. And in fact, we don't make any particular effort at the academies to determine who's a minority or who's not, to determine what box they fit in. But we're not quite ready for that as a society yet. There's still enough consciousness out there that wants to see how the military is doing and how the comparisons occur. And there is certainly some consciousness even maybe within our enlisted corps. Now, this is disappearing over time, and I think we will get to that, but maybe not in the next few years.
See, this reference to public expectation, though, I think is very dangerous. I mean, there was a public expectation at one time that the military be segregated. That was wrong. I think that the kinds of affirmative action that were undertaken to end that segregation was the kind of affirmative action that was good. That is, getting rid of discrimination, making sure that everybody in the military understood that discrimination on the basis of race and ethnicity was wrong. Casting a wide net, recruiting far and wide, not just sending recruiters to suburban high schools, but sending them to inner city high schools. All that kind of affirmative action is fine. But when you start giving preferences to people based on skin color and ethnicity, then you are into a kind of affirmative action that amounts to discrimination.
Let's take our first call. Jay's on the line now from Raleigh, North Carolina. Jay, go ahead.
Yes, I grew up in a small town, area of Alabama. I just want to bring that point. I was 99% white Caucasian, and then I went in the Marine Corps for about 5 years. And the Marine Corps and I guess the military service as a whole is teaching that race isn't an issue, and if they're using affirmative action to get rid of race being an issue, and whatever it's doing is working. I came from a lot of different backgrounds, and people in the service with me from a lot of different backgrounds, and we all came together, and it was an issue. We were all Marines. We were all the same, and I think that society and a lot of these organizations can take what the military is doing and put it to work, and it would solve a lot of the problems where race is an issue in our country.
I would normally never ask this question, Jay, but for the purposes of this conversation, are you African-American or are you white?
White.
And so from your perspective, why does it matter?
Well, it matters in society. It shouldn't matter, but it does. You see it on a day-to-day basis. And after coming out of the military, before that, it mattered because that's what you were being taught in the area you grew up in.
Right.
But after coming out of the military, it doesn't matter to you anymore. And if other organizations and colleges and schools can take what the military is doing to heart, it could probably solve race being an issue in our country altogether.
Ted Ostrom, do you share Jay's perspective that the military needs to be that institution of example for the country? I mean, is that even something that's thought about at the senior levels?
I can't think of a better institution than the military to be the example. And I'm not so sure it's thought of in any great depth at the highest levels that this is a driver for what we do. Hmm. It is certainly one of those discussions that occurs that says the importance of having this diversity in the military is of value to us because we are representative of the nation as a whole. So, that part is very important, but I'm not so sure it consumes a great amount of time and energy.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear Jay talk about it from the perspective of a kid growing up in Alabama, where the balance was so much more dramatically different than in other parts of the country. Roger, in your view, that doesn't change the value or the importance of taking affirmative action into consideration?
Well, I get very nervous when people start talking about representativeness. I think that what the military should be doing is selecting the best men and women it can, irrespective of their skin color or where their ancestors came from. Now, I think that for all kinds of reasons, that may result in some racial and ethnic groups being underrepresented and some being overrepresented. But for the military to go through and say, well, gee, we've got too many of this group and not enough of this group, and we want to match up the number in the enlisted corps with the number in the officer corps, is, I think, a very dangerous game. I mean, you could justify, if you have, quote, too many, end quote, whites in the officer corps, you could solve that problem by decreasing the number of African Americans in the enlisted corps. I think that would be wrong.
Is this the kind of math that goes
on? No, but Roger, I think you've missed the point there, is that there are no numbers involved with what we do to recruit officers. There is a sensitivity to the diversity of these officers. And to go back to a point you made before, I would say that 90% of our effort is to find qualified young folks across the country in minority groups and other groups to actually apply for something like the academies or to ROTC. And it is that effort, that 90% effort, that results in qualified folks that we do bring in without a number system.
Well, I think that 90% is fine, and I applaud that. What I'm saying is that the other 10%, where you are discriminating on the basis of race and ethnicity, ought to stop.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255 to North Freedom, Wisconsin now, and Rex joining us. Hi, Rex.
Hello.
Thanks a lot for calling.
Yeah. About 20 years ago, I was in the Marine Corps, having been enlisted, and at that time, a lot of the criteria for OCS was taken from the ASVAB test scoring. I myself was 2 points shy of qualifying for the OCS. However, had I had been black, I would have qualified for it. Now, we talk diversity, and we talk what type of prejudice is being used here. I know that at that time, of course, we're talking 20 years, and there is a difference, but it was a lower test score versus a higher test score. Now, what kind of prejudice are we talking about here today in regards to what ethnic group is allowed and what isn't allowed and what is the cutoff?
General Ostrom.
Well, to start with, there's no way that I could bring back statistics or thoughts about what occurred in the Marine Corps at that time frame. But test scores are only one of those factors. There are so many other things that you try to look at, certainly potential for leadership, potential to operate as an officer, if you would. And I will admit that certainly this diversity is one of those things that's in the back of the minds of those folks who do the voting, but not based on quotas.
Did you know, Rex, going into competition for that position, there was an affirmative action policy in place that was going to provide whatever kind of edge might exist for people who, you know, came in as African Americans or as members of minorities?
No, I did not at the time.
And you look back on that with the perspective of 20 years now, and how do you look at that? Do you think it was do you see it today as much as you saw it as a mistake back then?
I didn't necessarily see it as a mistake back then.
Oh, okay. I misunderstood you.
No, but what I'm trying to point out is that at that time, the test scoring, due to whatever background, other than the race issue, wasn't equal across the board. And because of that, there were black officers that were allowed to become officers with a lower test score than I myself had had. Not that I had any heartache one way or the other with it and such. However, when we're talking just prejudice, it often comes to mind that it's the minority that's being prejudiced against.
I mean, the reason I'm pushing you a bit on this, Rex, is that I want to know whether or not you felt resentment as a result of that, because in large part the whole notion of affirmative action is to try and, you know, find a balance and mitigate the resentment the other way around, and people like Roger make the point and very articulately that it creates as much resentment on the other side. What would you say to that?
No, I had no resentment. The only resentment I had was after serving 10 years and blowing out a knee and breaking my neck, not being able to go on and serve for another 10 to 15 for retirement. That's the only resentment I had.
Rex, thanks a lot for your call. It was good to have you on the program. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. Roger Clegg, time to hear from you here.
Well, I think that the caller is a very magnanimous guy, and I'm glad that he says that he didn't feel resentment, but I certainly think that it was wrong for him to lose out on a promotion because he was the was the wrong skin color. And I think that I can't understand how a system like that is good for morale, is good for efficiency, is good for effectiveness. It seems to me that when you have a system like that where winners and losers are being chosen in part, you know, not exclusively, but in part on the basis of race and ethnicity, that that's a bad thing for morale and effectiveness and efficiency.
Ted, we do talk about racial diversity, or the military talks about it as something which boosts morale, but what about Roger's point that it can also have the opposite effect?
Of course, it could be based on interpretation. What we don't know in Rex's case is what were the other factors that they used besides the test score. The only thing objectively he saw in front of him was test scores. But there may have been an assessment made on what was leadership potential. Maybe there was some other assessment made on motivation to make the career within the Marines. There's lots of factors that individuals use that will be and are subjective.
But in fairness, I mean, here we are 20 years later, and the same issues are coming up at the University of Michigan. You know, they'll say, well, maybe it's not this, maybe it's not color. If you keep it kind of mushy, there's always that safe area to retreat into. You know, you're saying, though, that in the search for diversity, that the African-American candidate will get that extra bit of assistance. I mean, Rex is reasonable to assume that plays into it.
I think so. Very much so.
So the resentment that might come from someone who's less magnanimous than Rex, that's something that you have to tolerate, in your view?
When you take a look at what the military services have been able to do to integrate and the diversification that they have achieved, you have to look at that in a positive sense. And in the absence of all emphasis on racial diversity, would we in fact be today as diverse and representative as we are? The answer in my mind would be no. So how would we have gotten there without some pushing and shoving and nudging?
And if some fingers get stepped on along the way, Connection listeners, is that worth the price of the military that General Ohlstrom is describing? And what kind of example do you see the U.S. military is providing for the rest of the country, in particular for American universities, as the University of Michigan case is being considered by the Supreme Court? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. My name's Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. With me in the studio, retired General Ted Ohlstrom, director of the National Security Program at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University, formerly superintendent of the U.S. Air Force Academy, and at NPR in Washington, D.C., Roger Clegg, vice president and general counsel of the Center for Equal Opportunity. Connection listeners, we're talking about affirmative action in the military as we understand it today and in context of the court case that's currently before the Supreme Court. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's start in Fayetteville, North Carolina. Michael's on the line. Hi, Michael.
Hey, how are you, Dick?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling.
You bet.
What do you think?
Well, Dick, I think that affirmative actions in the military works for two fundamental reasons. Number one, the military is not a democracy in the sense that we view the term democracy. And within that, we also have a uniform code of military justice, or if another way of saying that, if people are not familiar with the uniform code of military justice, is a way of dealing with punitive action.
Mm-hmm.
And that really deals really with a soldier's pocket, taking away money or disciplining them in other forms. Therefore, when a soldier comes in, we really don't look at their race or we don't look at their sex. If they're our superior, we follow their orders. And for the most part, this has worked well. It has benefited minorities to a large degree, and it has broadened many of us in a sense that we would have otherwise never have worked with individuals from other races.
Can I just pause you for a second, Michael? If we make the same comparison to private university, you could make the case, although on a much lesser scale, that there is a code of conduct and rules that govern the university, which is different from society. So the university is not entirely a democracy either, and that there are even you know, rules of university conduct, which set it apart as an institution in some way similar to the military. I'm just trying to follow you along on your on the way you're describing the military to see where we're going here in the way that it compares to universities.
Well, within the military, when a soldier comes in, regardless of their race, they must follow these rules, and if they cry foul or something like that, you know, it doesn't make any difference what their race or what their sex is. Many times, if they are just, you know, whatever the rules are, they must follow those rules.
So, are you saying that affirmative action in the military ought not to be compared to somewhere else? Or?
No, I think it's very difficult to compare the military's affirmative action with the civilian's version of affirmative action. If I work for a large civilian corporation, I have much more resources at my fingertips. I can sue my boss. I can muddy up the works. I can clog up the whole system mm-hmm. until my case is either heard or it's been determined that I'm really being treated fairly or unfairly. In the military, once a decision is made, it's made and we move on. I really think that the military model is great, because it does give everybody an opportunity who comes in a fair shot. You can go from private to sergeant major or from lieutenant to full bird colonel and beyond.
Let me just stop you there for a minute, Michael, because Ted Ostrom made the shift from superintendent of the Air Force Academy to life at Harvard University. Maybe you should weigh in on whether or not the rules that apply in the military, as Michael's describing them, do or do not work as a comparison or as a measure for what you see at Harvard or what you'd see elsewhere in society.
Well, I think there is certainly a huge difference between those societies and how they control themselves and manage themselves, but I don't know that that's the important issue here. The important issue is the kind of folks that we bring into the military, not necessarily how the military operates once they are aboard.
Go ahead.
So when you try to do this kind of comparison, it's an important point how people act once they get in the military. But the issue here is how to bring them in and who do you bring into the military.
Roger, what do you make of the parallel there, or the usefulness of trying to make one?
Well, I think that to me, it's wrong to discriminate on the basis of race, whether we're talking about the military or whether we're talking about General Motors. The lack of recourse that Michael referred to in the military, I think in some ways makes it more important that there not be racial and ethnic preferential treatment in the military, because it's harder to go to court.
Let me take you, if I can, Roger, back to
sure.
something that you said at the beginning of the program, and that is when we were drawing those two comparisons, you said, well, wait a second, let's be clear here that the University of Michigan admission policy is not an issue of national security, and that's one of the arguments put forward by the military leaders for considering racial diversity. When we talk about national security being something that military leaders feel is important for racial diversity, does that change the equation for you?
Well, I think that it's a different justification. I don't think that it is any more plausible than the justification given by the University of Michigan.
Right.
And I would also point out that, you know, while I think there are certainly some military officers that favor taking race and ethnicity into account, there's also lots of other people in the military who think that that's a bad idea. I mentioned Bruce Fleming, and of course, there's also the Commander-in-Chief.
1-800-423-8255. Michael, thanks for that. To Fayetteville, North Carolina, just across town. Renee's on the line now. Hi, Renee.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you for having me. I am former military at Fort Bragg for 7 years, and commenting on that, there was a great deal of equality in the military. You're all working at the same job for the same means, for the same ends, and you did tend to not notice differences in color, religion, whatever. You're all there for the same purpose. But I like to comment today on the fact that now we're looking at what I guess can be called a symptom of larger disease. And that's when you get to the point, say you're in the military and you're going over something like officer candidate school, and the grades may have been lowered, as the gentleman was saying, 20 years ago, where he got it, he was not allowed in, although his the grade point average for blacks at that point to get in the same service, officer's candidate school, were 2 points lower. Of course, that's an inequality. Of course, anyone should be upset, blacks included, in that inequality. The question is, where do we start to correct that inequality? It should occur long before one gets to the point where it comes into play. And, of course, that begins with education, so that blacks, Hispanics, whites all have the same opportunity to reach that point with the same abilities as anyone else, as one another. So we're looking at the end result of a deeper symptom.
And Roger Clegg,
lack of equality at the beginning.
Just stay with me if you can for a minute.
Working off a clear and even playing field when they get to that point where choices have to be made.
Renee, stay with us if you can, because I want to bring Roger in here. Roger, one of the strongest arguments that you make against affirmative action is that if we had a proper education system that served every child in the nation equally, we wouldn't have need for any of these conversations.
No, that's exactly right. And I don't think that we solve the problem of education inequalities by pretending that it doesn't exist and papering it over with a system of racial and ethnic preferences. I think the caller is exactly right that we ought to the solution to this problem is not effectively undertaken when somebody is 17 or 18 years old. It ought to be taken 17 or 18 years earlier. And I think that one of the important things that needs to be done in improving K through 12 education is forcing public schools, which are disproportionately attended by African Americans and Latinos, to compete with one another and to give African Americans and Latinos the school choice opportunities that a lot of other individuals have.
But General Ahlstrom, in the absence of that, at a time when the inner city schools don't produce the same, don't give a kid the same quality education that even the schools in the suburbs do, does affirmative action start, in your mind, at the university level in a way that affects the military? I mean, universities in many ways produce a lot of the people who end up as officers in the military, don't they?
I mean, Renee and Roger make wonderful points. In a perfect world, in an ideal world where the education system is responsive to the needs of the entire population, certainly there would be no reason for that. But the reality is we still are trying to build a military that's representative of society, that society has a full confidence in, that this is their military and supporting their country. So in absence of the idealistic educational system, there are a number of things that happen. Mike Jones made the good point that the preparatory schools that support our military academies, for instance, are there is something between a high school education and a college education to prepare people for just that. So the answer is you can start this at lots of different places. Not just there.
Sorry. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. Renee, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
I'm interested in hearing back from you on this. If the imbalance that General Ahlstrom is describing is still a part of society today, does that mean that for the time being, perhaps for the short term, that some form of affirmative action needs to be left in place?
Well, I understand the need for affirmative action. Of course, there needs to be some sort of balancing. And as he brought up before, as I was going to chime in, The preparatory, in my opinion, the preparatory to overtake that imbalance is what is needed. And I notice this in the job market, not only military university, but in the general job market and the civilian job market also. If you have people that have faced the inequality of lack of education to bring them up to the point they need to be to fit in, then there should be, before they reach that point, there should be some sort of preparatory course or action taken to bring them up to that point. If you know what's needed to reach a certain goal, then of course, and you know that certain people are going to come in that may not be prepared, there should be a course of action that you should have on the table to bring them up to that level, to make them more prepared. And I think that in the place of affirmative action, which is an imbalance, and will never be the answer.
All right, let me, if I can, just go back to Roger on this, because, I mean, Roger, if you say affirmative action is wrong because it creates segregation on the other side, but if you also recognize that there's an imbalance, is there a place for affirmative action in a very short-term perspective?
Well, I think that it's fine to take into account the fact that some individuals have not had the educational opportunities that others may have had, that there may be diamonds in the rough out there. But diamonds in the rough come in all colors. And I don't think it makes sense to assume that because somebody is an African American or because somebody is Latino, that therefore they must have grown up in the ghetto, mm-hmm. And that if somebody is white or Asian, they must have grown up in a mansion. You know, there's more poor white people in the United States than there are poor black people. If you want to have preferences or special programs to help people who come from poverty, that's fine, but it ought to be open to poor whites and poor Asians and poor Latinos and poor African Americans.
General Ostrom, I want you to look ahead for us, because we've been told that the Supreme Court is to hand down its ruling on the University of Michigan affirmative action case in the summer, late June, likely. Do you think it's going to change or could change the way the military recruits and brings officers along?
I don't think we've seen any definition yet as to what the Supreme Court ruling might entail in terms of breadth and scope. So the potential is there that it could impact the academies. There is potential that it could impact all the way down to K through 12. There's that potential. I think it's worthy to make the point that the military is somewhat concerned, hence the number of officers that signed the amicus brief, that if indeed this were even to apply to just universities, it could still impact the military services, because 75% to 80% of all our officers come from civilian universities, not from the academies.
So they
and
are.
That's an important point.
They are linked. Good point. All right. General Ostrom, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Dick.
General Tad Ostrom directs the National Security Program at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Roger Clegg, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Can I mention our website, which is ceousa.org? We have the study about West Point and Annapolis on the website.
All right, Roger, thanks for that. We'll have a link to it on our website. We are at theconnection.org. Roger Clegg's Vice President, General Counsel of the Center for Equal Opportunity. And earlier in the program, we talked with Colonel Michael Jones, Director of Admissions at West Point. Tara Murphy is our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.